Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is January 15, 2015. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. January is wrap-up month at the Solari Report, and we have published the wrap-up. We published last week. It's up on the blog, and you want to read the web presentation. There's an audio introduction, but the meat of it is in the web presentation. We're working on a PDF that will make it easier to print out, and I really hope you take the time to read that, because it's the guts of the fundamental analysis I do once a year to generate the scenarios I use to set investment allocations and strategy. So this is a very important one. The Solari team has worked several months coming into this, and we're very pleased with the result. And it's one of the reasons this week and next week I wanted to discuss aspects of it with Dr. Farrell and John Rappaport. So we're really taking some time this month to chew through it and talk about what's coming over the next year. We think the next year is going to be a year of incredible change, accelerating change, and it's unbelievably important for you to stay focused on what we're calling your free and inspired life. So we think this will help you separate what's important from what's not important, ignore the noise. So I really hope you take some time and enjoy the wrap-up. Well, our theme tonight is the Swiss shock, the global markets. It's cap off in the Alps. This morning, President of the Swiss National Bank, Thomas Jordan, abandoned the franc's three-year-old euro ceiling, 1.2 per euro. And the Swiss move came. It was unexpected, but it was in anticipation of an expected decision this week by the European Central Bank to decide it will buy government bonds, its own form of quantitative easing. The euro has already weakened about 14% over the past year against the dollar. Dollar up about since June, about 11 or 12%. This follows a decision from the Court of Justice in Luxembourg delivering a non-binding opinion on the issue of whether the ECB could proceed with a quantitative easing. And there's a link to the story about the court's decision. So it appears that the Swiss probably could not handle the flow of money flowing into the Swiss franc. And even though they have negative interest rates, so it gives you a sense of how much money is probably coming into them. Their currency traded up depending on the currency, but reports around the trading desks of trading up as much as 27 to 41% today at the peak. But the message is clear. Central banks are no longer aligned. And in fact, the Swiss National Bank noted that the market should expect discontinuity. He's saying division is, quote, a trend that is likely to become even more pronounced. That's division between central banks. As I said, the currency markets did not accept it. And there was one trader who was quoted on Bloomberg saying, quote, there was a good hour when Euro-Swiss was untradeable. Clearly, there was no liquidity. And in fact, in the currency markets and the fixed income markets, that's something to be expected this year. I'm sure it's not the only time we'll hear that there was no liquidity. And it's one of the reasons in periods like this, investors care more and more about the liquidity of any instrument they work with. Again, I don't think the Swiss could handle the flow of deposits, and it's worth thinking about what that says about what's going on in Europe. And one way I would describe it is, we talked about in the wrap-up, Europe is exploding. If you just look over the last week and a half, what's been going on, we have, of course, the Je suis Charlie shooting in France and the extraordinary 3.7 million person rally. We have Russia's Gazprom now cutting off or shifting their Ukraine transmission flows to Turkey. That article up on the blog. Also up in the blog, Putin signs a GMO labeling liability law, which is a real shot at the United States. And finally, very important story. It's up on the blog under topics. China and Russia announced they're going to launch a new credit rating agency in 2015, and don't think that isn't very important, because we've seen increasing politics played through the credit agencies here in the United States. And if alternative credit agencies in other countries gain the kind of credibility they need to operate in the global markets. That's going to really pose a direct threat to the Anglo-American alliance. And now we see today the Greek banks warning of the need for emergency liquidity. But what's really interesting is even though we're seeing real movements in the fixed income market that shows people are concerned about credit quality and liquidity, we're also seeing risk assets rise up, precious metals doing very well in the first month, and the Chinese and Indian stock markets both up. The Chinese market for the last 12 months is now up 18% versus 8% for the S&P. But if you look back over the last 6 months, what we've seen is tremendous volatility and liquidity issues starting to come up. Oil down 50% now today, the Swiss currency up 20 to 40%, the ruble, Russian ruble clearly trading down, and other currencies of countries that do are highly dependent on oil revenues down. And so the business community is now having to anticipate living in a world with these kinds of wild swings, including swings not anticipated. Central banks are often giving people lots of notification over the last 3 years of what they're going to do, this being a big surprise from the Swiss National Bank, and the extent of the moves extraordinary. Money in markets. The U.S. dollar continues to climb. As you know, one of the scenarios I'm most concerned about for this coming year is a very strong dollar. It's closed, or was trading today at the end of the day, at 92.1, having traded as far up as 92.6. The U.S. stock market off to a slow start this year. It's down 3%. I'm surprised it's not more. I was sort of expecting, hoping for more opportunities to shift capital in. The 20-year Treasury ETF just keeps climbing. It was up 27% last year. It's up another 7% from the beginning of the year. In fact, we're getting reports of record mortgage financing volume as rates drop and more people want to refinance. So if you've been considering refinancing your mortgage, I keep saying it can't go lower, but then it does. We had an announcement this week that the German and Japanese 5-year sovereign went to zero interest rate. And again, that shows extraordinary concern about risk. And in the fixed income markets, it's almost like the day of musical chairs is here, when everybody realizes that there are a lot more bonds than there are chairs for them to sit on. Interestingly enough, if you look at the star performer for the year to date so far, we see GDX and GDXJ up over the last month, 26 and 32%. Those are the gold miner ETF and the gold miner junior ETF. Remember, GDX is down 82% from its high, so part of the reason for the big bounce is they're so far down in the basement. But that'll show you the leverage versus gold, which is up 6% for the same period. And if you look at everything else, China up 2%, the corporate bond market up 1.62%, and EEM pretty much flat, down 0.5%. So I would say everything's soft or sort of going sideways with China, India, and precious metals being strong. I said in the wrap-up, I'm very concerned about the outlook for precious metals this year. So I'm just, as it went up and then faked out last year, I would be careful before I assume this is going to be a strong investment year for precious metals, but anything is possible. I mean, if we can see anything about the first 2 weeks of the year, it's be prepared to be surprised. The Gallup chairman wrote a comment on the number of companies that in the United States, they're more shutting down than are starting. The base is shrinking. And it's very noticeable that something this strong would come from the chairman of Gallup. What he says, essentially, I agree with, which is, if this trend continues, then the U.S. is toast. And that's exactly right. And the question is, what's really causing small business to be driven out of business? How do you turn that around? And what I would say is a lot of the policies that are driving small business out of business are intentional. And many of them are across the line of the law. And we've certainly been writing about them here at the Solaria Report for many many years, and the question is, are we willing to face the music and change? It will be interesting. It's interesting to see that kind of strength come from the chairman of Gallup. The Allianz had a very interesting piece on their blog on the top business risks around the world and brought real attention. They put up a map and you can link to it. It's up on the blog. But they noted the serious business risk from cyber hacking. And that's an interesting perspective. One of the things I'm thinking about is what we could do here at the Solaria Report to look more closely at what you can do to provide security against the kind of hacking that's happening. Although I think the real target is going to be business and government, not so much individuals. U.S. casino bankruptcies and closures are in the news. It's amazing to watch. I keep saying that Obamacare has done to casinos what preachers could never do. And gas has now dropped to $2 in Los Angeles. So talk about change. Our hero this week is a gentleman named Doug Hodge, who's the CEO of PIMCO. For those of you who are not familiar with PIMCO, they are a bond management firm in California that manages the largest bond fund in the country, the Total Return Fund. And they have been, they were co-founded by a gentleman named Bill Gross, who ran them until last year. And for the last several years has been having what I describe as the most childish public meltdown in the history of the bond market, or one of them. And there's a commentary that I wrote this week up on the blog. What's been very interesting, let me give you sort of my 411 on Bill Gross. Bill Gross started PIMCO and built it into the largest bond fund in the, or the total return fund into the largest bond fund in the world, and PIMCO the largest bond money manager or fund manager in the world. And he did it while the bond market was being used to do all the things we've talked about here, which is the financial debasement or the financial coup d'etat. You know, but essentially, Bill Gross was facilitating the financing of all those shenanigans and was very silent about them as long as it was making him huge amounts of money. While $4 trillion went missing from the Treasury Department, Bill Gross said not a word. When the mortgage securities market grew to, you know, more mortgages than there were houses in the United States, Bill Gross was silent. In fact, while the money was disappearing from Treasury, he sold the company to German financial services giant Allianz, never saying a word to them, I'm sure, about the risks in the U.S. bond market, and quiet all the way, became personally very, very wealthy. And then finally, when it was clear the long-term bull market was going to turn and he was going to be sitting on top of the largest bond fund in the world as there were real credit issues and real liquidity issues, he started whining very, very publicly and criticizing global governmental leadership and other leadership for their mismanagement of the bond market, which is really the pot calling the kettle black. And finally, he left and went to another firm and started a new bond fund, announced lots of money coming into him. It was later discovered that in fact, most of that money was coming from a manager in California who happened to manage his personal fortune. So anyways, you add it all up, and here's a fellow who's sold the firm to Allianz and failed to provide succession, failed to provide for an heir apparent. In fact, he drove his heir apparent out 2 years ago, sort of quit in a very public way. And so here's a guy who's made a real mess to the people he sold the firm to. He's made a real mess to the investors who've now been harmed. The bond is traded off from the publicity and the bad publicity. And he's really abrogated his responsibilities to employees. In the meantime, we have all sorts of people all over the internet talking about him as if he's some kind of hero who's fighting against corruption, which is even more depressing. But the point of the commentary was, since the very beginning, the PIMCO management has done nothing but act with grace and discernment under fire. They haven't, that I can tell, they haven't slipped up once, and they've stuck to their guns, tried to do a very good job under tough circumstances. And there's nothing, in a situation like this, there's nothing harder than keeping your mouth shut and staying gracious and staying focused on your work. So, as I said in the commentary, they're not out of the woods yet, but it's a real example of discipline and discernment and grace under fire. So my compliments, and as I said in the commentary, I'm impressed. Ask Catherine. Hello, Catherine. First of all, a Merry Christmas and all the best of the season to you and your family. May I also compliment you on the quality and depth of your Solari report. It's a breath of fresh air. Financial resources in a can that is found almost everywhere compared to the financial resources in a can that is found everywhere else. To my question, I recall hearing you say in passing that you're using a pulsed electromagnetic mat on a regular basis, but it was not discussed in any more depth. To my knowledge, I couldn't find the report, so I was wondering if you could give me a bit more information on experience using it and make model. That's the Quantron Resonance System, and I emailed a link to the specific system to the person who sent this. And it's also under up on the blog on the subscriber links on the interview that I did with Adam Trombley where we discussed it. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for all your insights. I'm a new subscriber and have listened and viewed your interviews in various places on the internet. I find your experiences and insights fascinating and helpful. A ground zero question. The federal government is studying allowing TSP participants. As a former Fed, I figure you know what the TSP is. Yes, it's one of the federal retirement systems. A window to allow TSP funds in an account to be invested outside the account. This is under serious study for possible implementation around 2017 timeframe. For the average Fed who has sizable money in the TSP, what would you suggest would be an appropriate retirement type vehicle for money moved from the TSP to outside the TSP? Obviously, due to the tremendous tax that the money would remain as a 401k. I'm not sure how they'll do it. One possibility is that they'll set this up so you have choices from a variety of the normal large financial institutions that provide choices to invest in a whole variety of index choices and funds. So they may have a more controlled form like that, or they'll just give you an option that you can shift the money. I don't know if it'd be a 401k or IRA that would allow you to manage it within the financial institution yourself, and theoretically even to a self-directed vehicle that would allow you to, in addition to do everything that you might do at a brokerage firm, would give you options to do something that was self-directed that would let you do real estate and precious metals. My guess is they're going to have something that's much more plain vanilla, either a set of control choices or the option to put it into a major financial institution in the form of the equivalent of an IRA or 401k that accesses a wide selection of the options you can get through a brokerage account. So we'll just have to see what they come out with. Dear Catherine, please let me thank you for your amazing work that you and your staff do. I'm a huge fan of your work, and I've passed on your work to my friends and family via Facebook. I believe that I understand the central banking model, and I'm actively working to listen through previous Solari episodes. I haven't said anything since I became a member. Is there a social media component to your work? No. I tried to do Facebook and became very unsatisfied with it and gave up on it. When we launch the new blog sometime in the first or second quarter, we're going to start to do a Twitter feed. And I have finally put up a post at LinkedIn. So what I would do is encourage, I want to do the Twitter feed because more than a few subscribers have asked us to sort of put out timely broadcasts on as immediate response to market events. So that's what we'll be using the Twitter feed for. And so keep an eye out for that because I think that may address your social media component. What is your assessment for the current low fuel prices consumers are seeing at the pumps? I could not imagine a world of cheap petrol in the age of peak oil. Has fracking allowed the central banking warfare model to exist past previous peak oil authors' estimates for collapse? Is this a sign of a future market crash? Has Mike Rupert's collapse model been disproven? I wasn't familiar with Rupert's collapse model, but my guess is if I had seen it, I would have disagreed with it. I think we are in a world of peak everything. Peak oil can be debated one way or another. I do think that the fracking technology has provided a bridge between the sort of an economy globally that's 90% dependent on fossil fuel to something else. So fracking has been a bridge. There are others that argue that the peak oil theory is not sound, and I won't get into that here because I do believe that peak everything is reasonable. But fracking has provided a relatively low-cost bridge. If you haven't listened to the interviews we did with Jim Norman, I would strongly recommend you do so. But I also think we're seeing the renewables technology and battery technology, solar technology steadily improve, and we're going to start hitting tipping points over the next 5 years. And as that happens, we are going to see the price of energy go down and far more productivity in the energy area. I do believe that the current drop in oil may not be last as long as a lot of people think, because I do think we're playing the oil card. And this drop has very much to do with the geopolitics of what's going on in between the United States and Russia and in Europe. So don't be surprised if you see the price heading back up in the spring. The reality is all of the different countries who are providing oil into the markets are saying they're going to pump, pump, pump. Part of it is they need to protect their revenue. So there's no doubt when the Saudi the other day said it's you're never going to see $100 again, that's absolutely possible. Dear Catherine, I've been a Solarium member for years, and still I was blown away from watching the presentations you've given us free access to from the 2014 Secret Space Program Conference. I particularly like the presentations given by you, Richard Dolan, and Dr. Joseph Farrell. During these presentations, it was mentioned that world governments, including the U.S., have been issuing trillions of dollars in bearer bonds pre-designed with small defects in them, and then later on, the governments then announced that these bonds have been determined to be forgeries, and they then refused to reimburse the investors for them. With this in mind, do you have any recommendations on how people can make sure they don't end up buying these bonds? I think if you buy them through a reputable dealer where the dealer is responsible and has continuous custody, or you use an ETF or a fund where they have a diversified pool or the fund's responsible to deal with any problems, you're protected. If you take delivery of bearer bonds, I think that's when you're going to run into real risks. Whether or not it's possible to get a good law firm to give you an opinion that they're clean and to get insurance to make sure you're protected sounds to me like a lot of work. So I would just work with reputable dealers and let the dealers have custody. Another way to avoid that problem is just do very high quality munis. So, and when I say munis, I mean municipals. Dear Catherine, with rare exception, the U.S. did not have personal income tax and corporate income tax until the 20th century. Since the implementation of income tax, government spending has risen from 2 to 3% of GDP all the way up to 30 to 35% of GDP. With this in mind, was the real reason behind the expansion of income tax here in the U.S. to make money out of the pockets of average Americans and to redistribute in the hands of the wealthy elite and the special interest groups? It was really to control and engineer the economy. So if I tax and force all sorts of spending and economic activity, I can much more direct the flow of credit and investment. So I think it was much more a credit mechanism. And in many instances, the people managing that credit mechanism would say it worked much better than a free market. What tends to happen, though, is you get everybody voting for the guy who will hand out the most money. And so the guy who taxes and then hands out the most money, whether it's as a result of monetary policy printing or rebates or appropriation spending, you know, pork, those are the people who the general population supports. So this is it's not just the elites. It's a two-way street between the general population wanting a free lunch and the elites finding it to their advantage to hand it out in a variety of ways. Hello, Catherine and Team Solari. I'm a new subscriber, which I feel very fortunate to the Solari Report, which I feel very fortunate to have stumbled across. A recent project with a startup inspired me to dig into our current economic system in order to understand the backstory on carbon emissions. That exploration has led me backwards to the history of oil and forwards to the weaponization of space with frequent trips down the money, media, and military rabbit holes. The questions I'd like to pose may have already been addressed in one of your reports, so I apologize in advance if this is ground you've already covered. Could you please help me understand the following? Which agencies or groups seem to be involved in Global 2.0 versus Global 3.0? We did a special report on who is the breakaway civilization, and I would recommend you look at that. One way to understand it is to study the early period of Area 51 and the defense contractors, particularly the guys who are the leaders on weapons and information technology, and the CIA, who is in charge of security, and the firms that work as contractors to them, both Area 51 and the space programs. If you study them and the intergenerational pools of capital involved, including in the running the drugs and the Exchange Stabilization Fund, you'll get a sense of who's who. But go listen to that Saleri report on who's who in the breakaway civilization. I think that will help. What is the goal of devaluing the Russian currency? What do you think is the desired outcome? I think the goal of what's happening between the United States and Russia right now is the United States is trying to ensure that Germany stays within the continental Europe and within the Anglo alliance instead of shifting to ally with Russia and China and sort of the companies and the economics along the Silk Road. So the goal is to keep continental Europe in alliance with the Anglo-American alliance and sort of keep Germany from breaking off and teaming up out on the Silk Road. And the sanctions towards Russia and the dropping the oil price are really targeted at busting Russia. To a certain extent, the falling ruble is the result of those sanctions and the targeting, but I suspect we're probably manipulating the currency markets as now. So you're talking about doing everything you can to bankrupt Russia with a low oil price and a low ruble, making it much harder for them to function in the world. And again, essentially, the goal of all of this is to maintain the dominant position in Eurasia. If you haven't listened to the annual wrap-up, I get into this and the sort of the extent to which the U.S. is trying to continue to dominate the flow globally in the Bretton Woods system and why Eurasia is such a big issue. So I would really encourage you to read the wrap-up. What African resources were captured by the U.S. and China during the Ebola outbreak event? Great question. I haven't gone in to try and research all the specifics. I believe one of our targets were the oil and gas deposits in West Africa. But I will definitely keep an eye out for the research that would give us more specifics. What is your view on how America could reach a consensus of the problem? I think if everybody could get America to read Richard Dolan's book on UFOs for the 21st Century Mind and also look at the financial issues of the black budget as well as entrainment and mind control technology, I think real illumination on that point would get us to the point where we're really starting to support the people who are honest with us and shun the people who are dishonest with us. A lot of this comes down to who we support, in our leadership, whether it's at the state or the local or the federal level. And the day we start to really exercise the choice to support people according to sort of whether they're acting within the law and in our self-interest is the day things can really change. What tactics can help individuals maintain emotional health, mental clarity, and fearlessness during disinformation campaigns? That's an excellent question. We're going to be doing Saleri reports on this. Everyone's different. John Rappaport and I talk about this a lot next week, so I would encourage you to listen to that Saleri report. Let me explain some of the things that I use to do so. One is I don't own a TV. I think if you consume a whole lot of media that denigrates humans, it's impossible to maintain a state of emotional health or coherence. So I simply don't own a TV. I haven't owned a TV since 1984, except when one of my decorators bought one when I worked in the Bush administration. As soon as I left, I gave it away. I think it helps to be cognizant of entrainment technology, how it works, and try to minimize your exposure. If you haven't listened to the Saleri report we did with Adam Trombley, I'd encourage you to listen to that. That will help. I do a lot of prayer. I find that part of this is really staying connected to the divine intelligence and getting advice from those quarters. So, I try and pray, and we have a prayer group every morning, which helps me tremendously. Exercise, I think there's a lot going on that's highly toxic, and there's nothing like hitting the punching bag for half an hour to help you get your perspective back. I try to ensure that the majority of the people I work with and socialize with have discernment on these issues. I also attend one or two churches that really nurture my spiritual strength and where people are very knowledgeable about the effort to do negative things towards us with the media. I try to overexpose myself to great culture, books, art, music. I really make an effort to listen and read people who are great at busting the disinformation. And it's one of the reasons I love Rappaport, because there's nobody better at busting their chops. I have a lot of faith in the possibility of a positive outcome, because I understand how the current economy is so shrunken compared to what it could be. I understand if you remove a lot of the oppression, the extraordinary increases in productivity that could happen are very dramatic. I also believe that it's essential to have a vision for yourself which is positive and one that attracts you to it. And so you're busy being attracted to your vision of what's possible as opposed to paying attention to the 800-pound gorilla or the shriek-o-meter that's trying to get your attention and distract you. So I think it's very important to keep your, as they would say, eye on the prize. Local economics. I work in a startup space in New York City, but I have some deep concerns about it. Mainly VCs control the money and make the most when the startups are sold on the market, acquired by large corps. Most incubators are really just office rental businesses. What do you make of these? And he points to an article on Startup Factories I haven't read, so I'll take a look at it. And I'm curious to look. Are certain states being targeted for devaluation? California. I am very concerned that California is being targeted by those who would like to own and consolidate control of the farmland in California. If you look at, and this was posted on the blog, if you click back, you'll find it. Economist had an article on farming about 2 weeks ago and showed that returns from U.S. farmland have been greater than returns on any of the global equity markets or real estate. So since 1994, farmland, U.S. farmland, has been the best performing asset class for institutional investors. Clearly, the farmland in California is some of the most desirable in the world. And as the Anglo-American Alliance pulls back into North America, one of the things that gives us great power globally is we are a real breadbasket, and we have tremendous export capability with food. And this is why the GMO issue and what Putin has done with GMOs is such a strategic issue. But it's also why, if you're getting control at a very central level of all the farmland in the country, that clearly California farmland is something you want. So I'm concerned that what's been happening with the weather is connected to an effort to consolidate farmland, or if it's not, it's going to be taken advantage of to do the same. So is California a target? I would say it's a target for consolidation, because it's, if anything, California is going to do extremely well as Asia rises. It's the part of the country that's closest to Asia, and San Francisco is scheduled to play a very important role in the San Francisco Fed, very important role in the development of digital and global currency. So I think California is in a very strong position, but I think it's got some serious change to go through, and I think there's real control wars. What is the Rockefeller Foundation's interest in clean energy and resilient city initiatives? I took a quick look at the Resilient Cities Initiative. I wasn't familiar with it. I think it's doing a variety of things. If you look at the wrap-up and read our presentation or my discussion of the rebalancing of the global economy, the economy is getting absolutely rocked and rolled as we slosh our way towards a global parity in income levels and equity market levels. That's going to be a long, many-decade process, but it can create a lot of chaos combined with weird weather and larger populations and environmental stress, and that includes megacities. The cities have a lot of challenges before them. So I think part of it is responding to all the different needs in those different areas and the stresses that are being put on the cities. I think part of it is, you know, you have the leadership is trying to build out the cultural infrastructure that will match a global government and currency. So if you're trying to build global government and global currency, it's very smart to get municipal leadership from all over the world working together on solving these different problems. It's a very sensible, intelligent thing to do. Also behind it is something which I call the break it, fix it model. What you're talking about is, you know, what we're looking at is a model where you do a series of things that destroy resilience. So you build a global narcotics trafficking operation that generates huge and hideous profits. It destroys a great deal of community and resilience, and then you take a percent of the profits and you come back in and you're the good guy and you try and rebuild resilience and you put money into the best and the brightest and you get them working on all these things and you socialize them in your programs, and it enhances the control that you've already created by making all the money that you've done to destroy the resilience. So it's very clever because it gets the best and the brightest working to even further your control more, and they're all very convincing. If you want to familiarize yourself a little with it, do a search on the internet and do the interview of Griffith interviewing Norm Dodd on foundations. It's very good. And I should just as a disclaimer remind you that my grandfather was dean of social sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation until he was fired for irritating the Dulles brothers. We have a long tradition in our family of irritating those quarters. Anyway, so as you can see, there you have some more questions, so I'll leave it here. I'm thinking about what the big theme we will focus on in the first quarter wrap-up is. If you look at the wrap-ups over the last year, each one we try and highlight and dive into a very important theme. For this year's annual wrap-up, it was planet equity. We also provided some very significant money maps to sort of help you get the 411 on what planetary equity looks like. But the big theme in each wrap-up is a chance for me to research something in depth. So if there's a big theme that you're interested in having me research for the first quarter wrap-up, I'm very open to suggestions. So keep that in mind. And if there's one you really want me to focus on, like megacities or something like that, we will do so. Next question. I understand the subject may not fit with any of your upcoming salary reports. However, I would request you share with your audience any thoughts you have regarding the writings of Walter Isaacson. His ideas and writings are very heavily promoted these days, as you all know. My request is understandably vague. Nonetheless, I ask this of you, having been an invaluable teacher to me in bolstering my comprehension of the governance system, and I have continuing questions about the promotion of Mr. Isaacson's works. Isaacson is the head of the Aspen Institute, and he is a writer of official history. So, you know, he's the guy who helps create the official reality. The only book I've ever read by him is called The Wise Men. It's a masterpiece of writing the official history. He has a new one out called The Innovators. And I have, believe it or not, somebody sent me a copy as a Christmas present. I wasn't intending to read it because I was assuming that rather than admitting where all the digital technology came from out of Area 51, instead we were going to be assured that Bill Gates was a genius and Microsoft was successful because he was so innovative, as opposed to he put a trapdoor in everybody's software for the NSA and they made sure it was successful. So I'm expecting it's a major official history, but when you're trying to create a new piece of official history, you get somebody like Isaacson to write a book, and then you promote the bejesus out of it, and that's what it is. If you read the chairman of Gallup's editorial or commentary that I was talking about early on, he was talking about the importance of innovation to the U.S. economy and how innovation was being destroyed by wiping out the small businesses. I agree totally. And I suspect what they're doing with Mr. Isaacson's work is trying to promote the idea that what's going on is great innovation. The problem is that if you look at the innovation that's happening, it's way too controlled and it's way too sort of engineered to create you know, more control. And I think the challenge at the top is going to be, you know, markets really work. How can you let there be sufficient freedom to have real innovation? Because innovation requires a very yeasty, out of control freedom. And that hasn't been something that's been happening, as you well know. So it'll be interesting to see how we get to the point where we start to really support the things in the economy that we need to be successful. When I was talking to Dr. Farrell, I pointed out this week that in our discussion that the Economist had just had an editorial lambasting the U.S. policing and enforcement system for being so evil that it was killing the economy. I couldn't agree more, but you kind of wonder why they haven't said anything for the last 15 years, but now I'm glad they did. And we have the Wall Street Journal writing an excoriating editorial, just furious about prosecutorial abuse. And, you know, what they're all saying is the corruption is out of control and it's destroying the economy. And I said, yeah, I agree. So this issue seems to be coming to a head. You can't destroy innovation on one hand, make money harvesting innocent people on another hand, be lawless on another hand, and then turn around and say, you know, why is the economy not working? So anyway, so it's going to be very interesting because you can't address productivity without addressing these very issues. It'll be fun to see what happens over the next year. And let's go to the movies. A great documentary by an early sort of elementary education pioneer, Albert Cullum, was an actor and decided he'd become an elementary teacher, and absolutely fantastic. You just have to see it. It's a reminder of what great education can be, simply inspiring. It reminds me a little bit about the other documentary I published last year, and Let's Go to the Movies, encouraging you to watch, called The School, about a Russian school currently operating that's absolutely fantastic. And these are, I think, very important to watch because as we watch Common Core literally destroy our school system, it's very important to remember that education can be a miraculous, utterly fantastic, inspiring experience. We know how to do it. It's not that hard to do. There are great examples and great documentaries about how to do it. So I think as more and more people homeschool or start private schools or find ways of providing great education to their children while Common Core is literally destroying the educational system, it helps to have documentaries like this to remind you. Our interview tonight again is with Dr. Joseph Farrell. We're talking about the wrap-up and some of the key issues that resonated the most with him. We had a great talk about my concern about what I call the U.S. dollar bear trap, where the U.S. simply puts the entire BRIC nations and a lot of the G20 over a barrel with a high dollar and really sort of pulls the leash, so to speak. And Farrell turned around and did a great interview, a great blog post on the topic on his blog, and I posted that up on our blog post. So it's a very interesting discussion. I hope you listen, but you want to make sure you take a look at the annual wrap-up first, and that link is going to be in the subscriber link in the after you log in the annual wrap-up blog post. So that's it for tonight. Lots of great questions. Thank you. Keep them coming. Next week, John Rappaport, Free and Inspired, we're going to be talking about the more personal, intimate aspects of the annual wrap-up. And then the following week, a great interview with Dr. Catherine Albrecht. She's going to be back talking about spy chips. This time we're focused on her new book about warning children about spy chips. So that's it for this evening. And please remember, until next week, January 22nd with John Rappaport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.